At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And tonight on Queer Voices, Q-Fest, Houston's gay and lesbian film festival, is celebrating its 15th anniversary this year. The film festival will showcase an inspired selection of shorts and features from around the world, beginning next Thursday, July 28th, and running for 5 days. Christian Salinas will be joining us with more details. In news wrap, the state of California now requires public schools and social studies textbooks to teach about LGBT people's contributions to the economic, political, and social development of the state and the country. New York State is preparing for gay weddings starting in July, and that has inspired new moves for marriage equality in Maine, Maryland, and Colorado. And the legal battle in federal court over Don't Ask, Don't Tell wears on, but legislative repeal is in the works, too. Out and Equal presents Ally Empowerment Event. A week from tomorrow, the speaker for the event will be Celise Berry, the founding executive director of Out and Equal. Matthew Sontag will join us to describe Out and Equal's mission and provide details of next Tuesday's event. At 10 o'clock, we will have a discussion on the dedication next Thursday of the Montrose Remembrance Garden at the corner of California and Grant Streets. Mayor Anise Parker and several city council members will be on hand for that event. Then Joel Angel Babb will join us to talk about Unhinged Productions' production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. From a queer perspective, it's being billed as the unhatched production of the famous play written originally by William Shakespeare in the 1590s. In the feature segments from This Way Out, Republican presidential hopeful Michelle Bachmann, a Minnesota congresswoman, has come under fire for promoting so-called reparative therapy to supposedly make gays and lesbians heterosexual. She and her husband Marcus jointly own and operate a self-identified Christian counseling center where the supposed therapy is conducted. And Torn Apart, United by Love, Divided by Law. That's the title of Julie Rickard's new book about the perils faced by same-gender bi-national partners in the U.S. And so I see from the look on your face that I mispronounced the name of the first guest.
You did. It's Salinas.
It was going to be one or the other, and I got it wrong.
We apologize, but...
And you're forgiven.
Thank you.
Interesting thing I saw today, Lee McGuire, who was the former Channel 11 reporter here that covered City Hall, and his partner, Colin Mitchell, got married.
Yes. Oh,
and what's really interesting about that, their announcement was listed in the New York Times.
Now, that's making it there.
Pretty incredible. It's incredible that the New York Times does this.
If you watch the video on that little thing, they met on MySpace. So internet love can happen, yes.
So, you know, these policies do matter.
Absolutely.
Yes, they do.
Well, we have a lot of things going on tonight, and we're in the middle of summer, and usually we don't have a lot of things going on, so that's great. There's things going on in the
community.
We
got a full show.
So we will get right to it.
There's a girl that you might know. She's a friend. At least I tell you so, but it might surprise you to find there's something going on behind the door. When I'm asleep, it gives me time to think thoughts that I wouldn't dare speak aloud. I couldn't bear myself before a crowd.
That fun little song was from 2004 by the Diddy Bops. Actually, the record is called The Diddy Bops, and the title of the track, There's a Girl. This is Queer Voices.
This is Brian Levinka, and I'm wondering if listeners of Queer Voices know that there is a gay and lesbian film festival, and if so, or if not, do they know that it's starting next week? So in the studio, we have the people that are most involved with putting on QFest, Houston's Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, in the studio tonight. Welcome, Christian Salinas.
Thank you.
Marion Luntz.
Hi.
And Sarah Gish.
Howdy.
Okay, now each of you tell me what your role is in QFest and how you're involved.
I'm Christian Salinas, and I am the board president, previously the executive director of the festival.
I'm Marion Luntz, and I'm one of the co-founders of the festival, and I'm also at the Museum of Fine Arts, and we're one of the venues.
And I helped co-found the festival with Marion, and we'll talk about that. But it was actually here where it all started.
So this is the 15th year, mm-hmm. correct?
The Queer Signora, yes.
Yes.
Try to say that three times fast.
if you see the advertisement for it, it's Queer Signora.
That is correct.
I'm butchering that. But this is the 15th year, so it's a milestone year. So tell us what is special about the 15th year, Christian.
Well, I think the most wonderful thing about this particular festival is that after 2008, as many people know, Ike pretty much blew Houston off the map. So this festival represents a return, a very important one, and the collaborations that we've had with many of our venues to help revive the organization after essentially a two-year hiatus.
Tell us about the venues. There's a couple of venues.
Two of the venues this year, Museum of Fine Arts and Rice Media Center, are actually what we call our founding partners, and they were involved with the festival from the very beginning. Our third venue is a new one, Discovery Green, and we're actually doing a partnership with several organizations, Fresh Art, Space Taker, Houston Cinema Art Society, and Tuts, to present an outdoor screening of Xanadu.
That's going to be the gayest thing ever.
Yeah. Totally the gayest
thing ever. With roller skates.
And blonde wigs.
I can see it now, like the little short shorts and the roller skates. And
leg warmers.
All the queens out. So it's going to be, let's talk about the schedule.
Yes.
When is opening night, and what are the different nights that it goes on?
Opening night is our biggest night. It is Thursday, July 28th, 7 p.m. at the Museum of Fine Arts. We also do centerpiece selections, and this year's American centerpiece is a film called August, which will be showing at Rice Media Center on Friday, July 29th at 9 p.m. We also have an international centerpiece featured at the Museum of Fine Arts. The film is called Two Frogs in the West, and that'll be showing also Friday, July 29th at 7 p.m. And we have a documentary centerpiece entitled Making the Boys, which will be at the museum on Saturday, July 30th at 3 p.m. And our closing night feature, a film called Violet Tendencies, which will be featured at Rice Media Center on August 1st, which is a Monday, at 7 p.m. That's also going to be our tribute to the founding ladies of QFest.
And you need to go see that because of Minnie Cohn.
Exactly, yeah.
If you haven't seen that. Oh, I love her.
And, you know, I want to add something. The song that you were playing earlier by the Diddy Bops, we're actually featuring a short film in the Boy Shorts program, which is on Saturday at July 30th at 5 p.m. at the museum. Amanda Barrett, who's a member of the Diddy Bops, is a part of a troupe called Pretty Things, and they have a program in that Boy Shorts program.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the history, about how this all got started and how we got to the point we are now. Who would be best to talk about that?
Well, I want to throw in the website, first of all, because Christian was talking about a lot of films, and I want to touch on some of the other films later that he didn't get to, because he has a great lineup of both recent films and new films and classic films, and I think that's really the strength. It's the strongest edition we've ever had, and we don't say that every year. But the website is q-fest.org.
Everything is there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, everything we're talking about, you can go and read about on the website. Now, let's talk about the history.
Okay, well, Sarah's...
So it was born here. Well, I was working for Landmark Theaters, and we had a history of showing gay films over the years, mm-hmm. and as did Diverse Works. And Rice Media Center, I think, showed a handful.
And the museum did,
And of course, the museum, sorry. But Marion and I were here one night talking about, touting some of our gay films, and a caller called in, and Marion doesn't remember this at all, but I do. A caller called in and said, hey, why don't you do a festival? And I remember I just had a little light bulb moment, let's do that. And so then we rounded up Rice Media Center. We got Liz going and Rachel and Laura's.
Swamp.
And we got Swamp as our fiscal sponsor.
Works.
Yeah, and Diverse Works. And Diverse Works already had sort of a mini gay festival every year. And so we kind of joined forces. And it was just a great opportunity for all of us to band together and say that we support the gay and lesbian community. And to make it a regular thing, I'm a real creature of habit. So to have something every year was really good for us. And for me personally, I don't know, I'm sure you guys felt the same way. You know, Austin, our closest neighbor, had a film festival for years.
You're saying that is they do not now?
No, they still do.
They
do.
It's a big, very big
has.
One.
Yes. Yeah. Has is yes, current.
Currently, yeah.
Currently still has.
I think it's a very Houston thing to feel like, how come these other cities have it, especially Austin and Dallas, but in general, and why don't we? And I think that was part of our motivation was, let's not just show these films, let's continue showing these films, I should say, throughout the year as part of our organization's programming, but let's do a festival once a year, even if we can't do, a complete red carpet, high-end thing like some places do. Having a festival is meaningful for the community and for the films and for the filmmakers.
Absolutely. Now, why are gay films important? Why would you say?
Well, in this day and age, I think, for our festival, the whole point of showing the selections that we do have is to bring a variety of audiences together, be they gay, straight. It doesn't really matter, young, old, into film, not into film, but it's to open up a dialogue. It's to reveal just how diverse this community is, just to the number of people who've lived here all their lives and for those who've just moved here. And this festival really has consistently offered a wonderful opportunity to do that.
And it's interesting. When you were talking, I was thinking about the movie Brokeback Mountain. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was really an interesting time period when that came out.
It was groundbreaking.
All kinds of people were watching it that I would never have expected to see a gay film. So I think that kind of opened the doors, too, when that came out a few years ago and got people okay with seeing, men making love and doing all these, women
kind
doing
of
things.
On a big scale.
On a big scale, yeah.
Marion, why are gay films important?
Oh, I think it's, I second what Christian and Sarah said, but just as part of our lives and our culture, it's important to show all different perspectives, and that's definitely what we're committed to as far as the programming mission at the museum, is that we'll show films from in all different languages, from all different parts of the world, but also just reflecting people who, have different kinds of lifestyles and live however they choose to, and it just seems important. And these are excellent films. We're not just programming films to fit the theme. It's Christian has a wide choice of movies every edition and really very carefully tries to balance it.
Now, and they're more fun, too, usually.
Absolutely. Now, Christian, what movie are you most excited about showing?
Hands down, it's going to be Boom. With Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, and Noel Coward.
Now, tell our listeners if they do not know what that movie is about.
Well, first I want to say that the film is not available on DVD, so don't make that an excuse not to see it. It is a phenomenal film from the late 60s at a time when Liz Taylor and Richard Burton were making very crazy, wild movies. It's brilliantly over the top. It's an adaptation of Tennessee Williams. There's not much I can say. You just have to see the movie.
Christian, what's that line from the trailer?
Oh, my goodness. So the narrator of the trailer, in introducing Richard Burton's character, says that his character walks the vague line between lust and saintliness.
Yeah, love that.
You know, and I had never heard of this movie, so I started doing research, and now I'm dying to see it. So
the trailer is wonderful.
I never, you know, I guess I come from the generation kind of after that, and I didn't know about it. So I'm excited to see that. What about you two? What are you?
Well, I think Xanadu and roller skating and all that hoo-ha is going to be a lot of fun at Discovery Green. I, unfortunately, am going to be out of town for all this. So,
and
I really,
it.
You will. And I would love to see Violet Tendencies, too. I think that one sounds great. So I'm excited for all that because I think Mindy Cohn is funny.
On the Kaleidoscope, that before Xanadu screens, there will also be an art walk and performances. And we're really happy to be collaborating with Tuts and Space Taker and Fresh Arts Coalition and Houston Cinema Art Society. It's a huge collaborative event, and people will have the opportunity to just really enjoy being at Discovery Green, being with their friends, and then eventually putting on their roller skates.
So it's a cultural event, not just a big old gay movie outside.
shared happiness.
You can bring 1,000 of your closest friends.
So, Christian, you went away for 2 years. What brought you back to this?
Well, actually, I've been away for about 7 years in Los Angeles, and I've been managing a number of aspects of the festival. But after 2008, we had this moment where, you know, one of my board members and I were trying to decide what the future of the festival was going to be, and I just happened to come across an opportunity to move back to Houston. I'm working a day job with Texas Accountants and Lawyers for the Arts, another nonprofit, and you know, because of them, I've had the opportunity to really, you know, work to bring this festival back. And we couldn't pass up the opportunity to do a Quercinera. We couldn't.
Excellent. And Christian has been working very, very hard. I mean, he does everything.
What does it take to put this festival together? I'm sure there's just hours and hours.
Insanity.
It is a lot of work.
Do you start a year out, 6 months out?
We actually started a year and a half out. Pretty much when I moved here, almost a year and a half ago. But even before that, we were already discussing doing the 15th anniversary and pretty much skipping over the 14th.
Yeah, kind of putting all your...
yeah.
Your oomph into the 15th. Yes.
And then a lot of just kind of how you led, Brian, saying how many people listening know that Houston has a gay and lesbian film festival. And a lot of the work is making connections and having co-sponsorships and getting aligned with other organizations for each of these films and carving it up and saying, who's the target audience for this film? In fact, fortuitously, Bill Arning, who's the director of the Contemporary Arts Museum, contacted me and said, I'm interested in this documentary, Making the Boy, about the boys in the band, because it relates to an exhibition they have on view. And I said, wow, that's showing at Q-Fest. So we put Bill together with Christian, and now the CAM is a partner on that particular screening.
And that was the fun part, too, with Xanadu. We had that originally intended for the museum outdoors, and Houston Cinema Arts had an outdoor event planned the same night, and we just moved it over and partnered with them.
God wants a gay film festival.
He really does. In Houston.
Exactly.
And the partnerships that it forges have been great. Starting from the very beginning. I mean, it was a partnership deal.
They continue 15 years later.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, if you're listening to us, we're talking about the Q-Fest, Houston's Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. And if you haven't partaken of the film festival, I highly suggest it. It's a wonderful community event. Everybody loves film. Everybody loves movies. And so to kind of commiserate and come together and just, you know, celebrate our community on screen is amazing. So I highly suggest it. Now, let's talk about we can't mention ticket prices on the air, but where can people get tickets?
They can purchase tickets on our website, www.q-fest.org, and also on the museum's website at www.mfah.org/film.
And also, there's a couple of... Christian, can you mention the events that are coming up this week? I think
can
do that.
Yes, we actually have two events where people can buy their tickets in advance. One will be Wednesday, July 20th, starting at 5 p.m. at Guava. And then a second event, we're doing a launch party with Swamp at the Fairview on Tuesday, July 26th, starting at 6:30 p.m. And at both events, we're going to be screening trailers for the films.
Absolutely. Okay, so what else do you want our listeners to know? We're wrapping up here.
To check out the website, friend us on Facebook, mm-hmm. and to get involved in the program, get involved in the organization.
Absolutely. Kristen's always looking for volunteers, too.
Absolutely.
So how can we get volunteers? Can contact you?
They can email me at info@q-fest.org.
So go check out the website, pick a movie, go see all the movies. There's even a pass, so you can see everything. And participate and watch these wonderful films that are brought to us by Q-Fest and the Houston's Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. Christian, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Queer Voices.
The Santiago-based Chilean newspaper La Tercera is reporting that President Sebastián Piñera will be introducing a civil unions bill in the coming week. They would be available to gay and lesbian couples who can't marry in the country, and also to heterosexual couples who can marry, but for whatever reason don't want to. Qualifying couples would have to have lived together for more than 1 year. Piñera told the El Mercurio newspaper that the measure would safeguard the dignity of those couples, whether of opposite sex or even the same sex. According to the On Top magazine website, civil unions in the heavily Roman Catholic country would be a legal contract called a non-marital cohabitation agreement. Chile's largest LGBT advocacy group demonstrated against Piñera earlier in his term for refusing to follow through on a campaign promise to support a civil unions bill. If the new proposal passes legislative muster, Chile will become the fifth South American country to offer civil unions to same-gender couples, joining Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, and Uruguay. Argentina opened civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples last year. Queer couples can also legally marry in the city-state of Mexico City. The Supreme Court has ruled that those marriages must be recognized nationwide.
Uruguay became the first Latin American country to legally recognize gay and lesbian couples with civil unions in 2007. But now, the LGBT rights group Colectivo Ovejas Negras, Black Sheep Collective, has launched a TV ad campaign featuring 34 national celebrities endorsing full civil marriage rights for same-gender couples. A bill to do just that was introduced earlier this year. According to the collective's Alvaro Quiruga, the bill, written by Uruguay's first transgender lawyer, will soon be discussed by Parliament, and we're optimistic.
Argentina's La Nación newspaper reported this week that 2,697 lesbian and gay couples have wed since marriage equality became the law of the land there on July 21, 2010. About 60% of the happy couples have been men and about 40% women. Ceremonies have been held in every state, with Buenos Aires taking top honors. Lawmakers approved the law over the strong objections of the Roman Catholic Church. One cardinal called the marriage equality movement the devil's handiwork. Activists have said they're unaware of any problems since the law took effect. But the Associated Press reports that many gay and lesbian newlyweds have complained about difficulties getting civil authorities to register their children under both parents' names. The opponents have launched a petition drive calling on lawmakers to repeal Argentina's marriage equality law.
Newly released government statistics in Spain reveal that 18,634 same-gender couples tied the knot between 2005, when it became possible, and the end of 2010. 2.1% of all marriages in Spain last year were between same-gender couples, according to the official statistics. There's been ongoing rhetoric from the opposition Partido Popular, People's Party, about repealing the marriage equality law. Activists say lesbian and gay couples, fearing a Partido Popular victory in the next elections, have been marrying at elevated rates.
And Canadians will mark the sixth anniversary of marriage equality there in the coming week. Post media reporter Naomi Lakritz noted that the naysayers darkly predicted the seismic crumbling of Canadian society as we know it. They said the gay agenda would undermine heterosexual marriage and families. So despite the advent of marriage equality, she concluded, the sun has continued to come up each morning. Nobody has married their cat, their tree, or their favorite living room chair. No priest has been forced to marry same-sex couples. No pedophiles have married children. There have been no reports of societal crumbling in any other marriage equality locale.
The cities of New York and Albany were among the first to announce that they'll unusually open municipal government offices on Sunday, July 24th, exactly a month since New York's civil marriage equality bill was signed into law, and the first day that gay and lesbian couples will be able to legally marry in the state. And the New York Times called it one of the most unusual judicial mobilizations in years. From Buffalo to the Bronx and pretty much everywhere else in New York, the paper reported, judges are signing up for rare Sunday duty. In what the Associated Press said would literally be a theatrical event, a group of same-gender couples will marry on July 25th on the Broadway stage currently hosting a revival of the Summer of Love musical Hair. According to Rory O'Malley, who stars in the Tony Award-winning The Book of Mormon and co-founded the LGBT rights group Broadway Impact, several lesbian and gay couples from the Broadway community will be married on the stage of the St. James Theater right after that evening's performance. And a gay South Australian member of parliament announced this week that he'll challenge his country's ban on recognition of same-gender marriages legally performed abroad. Upper House MP Ian Hunter and his partner of 22 years, artist Leith Simmons, plan to tie the knot soon in New York.
The passage of marriage equality in New York has also inspired activists in at least three other U.S. states. Less than 2 years after voters in Maine overturned that state's legislatively enacted marriage equality law, gay and lesbian advocates and defenders, the legal group that spearheaded marriage equality in Massachusetts, announced with Equality Maine that they've started to gather the required 57,277 signatures on petitions to put marriage equality back on the ballot in November 2012. Opponents say the divisive issue was already settled in that statewide vote in November 2009, but marriage equality proponents claim that a significant number of Maine voters have changed their minds in the past 2 years. Matt McTeague of Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders told the Associated Press that polls show 53% of Mainers now support opening civil marriage to same-gender couples. The same margin opposed that idea in 2009.
A coalition of LGBT rights groups has launched a renewed campaign to get a marriage equality bill passed during the next session of Maryland's legislature, which begins in January. Marylanders for Marriage Equality brings together Equality Maryland, the Human Rights Campaign, and Freedom to Marry. The state Senate passed a bill opening civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples in February, but the bill was shelved in March when proponents couldn't round up enough votes in the House of Delegates. Governor Martin O'Malley told reporters this week that he'd support a marriage equality measure that has religious exemptions similar to those in New York.
An attempt to pass civil unions legislation failed in the Colorado State House earlier this year. It did pass in the state Senate, guided by its openly gay sponsor, Senator Pat Steadman. He told the Associated Press that the time was also not right to push for marriage equality. But that's not stopping some Colorado college students who say they'll try to gather the required 86,000 signatures to put a marriage equality proposal on the state ballot in 2012. It would reverse a 2006 voter-approved constitutional amendment defining marriage in Colorado as exclusively heterosexual. An effort to remove the amendment in 2010 failed to gather enough signatures. LGBT rights groups, including One Colorado, continue to believe that the issue should be addressed by the legislature and not at the ballot box.
Meanwhile, the legal battle over Don't Ask, Don't Tell continues. A three-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals lifted its stay late last week of a lower court decision that declared the policy to be unconstitutional, effectively ordering an end to its enforcement. The 9th Circuit ordered the Department of Justice earlier this week to advise Congress if it didn't plan to further defend the clause requiring U.S. military policy in the federal lawsuit filed by the LGBT log cabin Republicans. The Justice Department then said that it would, arguing that repeal should follow the process outlined in legislation approved by Congress and signed by the President last December. Mandated Pentagon design training in advance of repeal is expected to conclude in the next few weeks. But the policy enacted in 1993 would not officially end until 60 days after the President, Defense Secretary, and Joint Chiefs Chair certify that the U.S. military is ready for repeal. And late on July 15th, the 9th Circuit responded to the Justice Department filing by temporarily reinstating the stay. But the appeals court kept in place the part of the original ruling that prohibits the military from investigating, penalizing, or discharging anyone from the military pursuant to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Gay journalist Rex Walkner has suggested that the current permutation of the policy might now be called Can't Join, Can't Get Kicked Out. The 9th Circuit ordered the Log Cabin Republicans and the Justice Department to respond to these latest developments in the coming week.
And finally, in a U.S. first, Governor Jerry Brown has signed into law a bill sponsored by openly gay Senator Mark Leno that requires California public schools to teach about LGBT people's contributions to the economic, political, and social development of the state and the country. The new law also prohibits classroom instruction and school-sponsored activities that promote a discriminatory bias on the basis of sexual orientation. It also requires newly acquired social studies textbooks and other social sciences instructional material used in California to adhere to the bill's inclusive requirements. The bill sat on Governor Brown's desk for several days as opponents flooded his office urging him to veto the bill, and equality organizations rallied LGBT people and their allies to communicate their support. A right-wing group is already mobilizing its minions to try to overturn the new law at the ballot box. Shannon Minter, legal director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, called Brown's signature a major turning point for our movement and predicted that it will change the future for LGBT youth and their families in ways that are just as important and far-reaching as marriage equality. That's News Wrap for the week ending July 16th, 2011. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride. Read the text of this week's News Wrap online at thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm Jen Mahoney.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
This is Queer Voices.
Back when Harvey Milk was on the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco, I don't even think he had it on his radar screen that we'd be talking about equality in the corporate world. That subject has really sort of moved forward in the past, you know, past while. There's been a lot of work done on it. I know HRC has a list of good companies to work for, good companies to buy stuff from. Matthew Sontag is with, what is the group you're with?
Out and Equal.
And what is that group? Tell me about it.
Well, there's sort of a two-part answer to that. Out and Equal has a national group, obviously, that is focused nationally on workplace advocacy, basically taking it past the corporate statements, the HRC gold standard, meeting all of the basic criteria that you get to be considered a gay-friendly employer, and saying, well, that's great. Corporate up top says you can be gay at our workplace. Now how do we translate that into the offices? So it really is truly an organization focused on putting equality into the actual office where people are doing the work. Because of that, it is sort of focused at larger companies, although we draw membership from even very small employers, down to the point where the idea of having an equal workplace at the corporate level and the internal office, I mean, obviously, if you've got 8 employees, the policy is the reality. And so we're sort of there to bridge that gap.
How long has the organization been around?
Nationally, I want to say the group as a whole has been around just over a decade.
Really?
And that sort of actually draws back to my two-part answer earlier. Okay. There's the national group, and then there's each of the chapters. There's sort of a local chapter in major metropolitan areas. Houston's chapter is into our second full year. You know, it was started again as an outgrowth of a couple of local organizations, but really focusing on, you know, Houston as a market having some very enormous employers, some of whom may not have the best reputation for translating their corporate policy into the actual workplace. And so as an outgrowth of a energy-focused group here in town, it sort of expanded and realized, okay, we've gotten all the oil companies on board. Now let's bring roll it out to everyone else. And that effort's been underway for a little over 2 years.
And Houston is sort of a different animal than some of these other metropolitan areas. You talk about San Francisco, where they actually have city ordinances that deal with it. And you talk about some cities that have insurance companies that are big ones, or banks. Houston's sort of the good old boy town with the roughneck or, you know, oil companies and stuff that are good old boys. And in fact, there used to be a city hall reporter, and it was either Jessica Savage or somebody like that, where they used to refer to as girly. So we've come a long way. And how is it in Houston compared to some other cities?
Well, I think it's safe to say that we had a little bit steeper hill to climb, just because of the inherent bias in a lot of the city's industries. And as you said, it is sort of a good old boys town. The rank and file here may not have the same attitude towards our community that would be the case in San Francisco or any of the major metropolitan areas on the East Coast. We just got a slightly slower start, which sort of makes it more important. And then I think the other thing that is notable here is that our community is not as prepared, you know, because there is this perception. Yeah, the major employers, the oil companies, the financial services, the oil companies. I hate to harp on them, but they've earned it. There's a perception that they're not friendly. And so regardless of what the in-office reality is, all of the GLBT straight ally employees are going to think that their company is going to live up to the stereotypes. Management on high, whether it's in California or Irving or wherever that is, may walk the walk and talk the talk, but when it comes down to it, my supervisor won't. And so that's sort of a unique challenge here, I think.
And how do you do this? How do you go into these corporations and talk to the management or talk to the lower-level managers?
Well, that's actually sort of the bread and butter of what we do, and in fact, I'm a good example. I'm here representing Out and Equal, but I'm actually an employee for one of the companies. It is driven sort of internally by people that are willing to take that first step, whether it is a out member of the community working at an employer or the human resources, the local human resources contact that reaches out and says, hey, we're recognizing the need to retain the best talent. We want people to bring their whole selves to work, all of the wonderful employment buzzwords that we throw around. And so our outreach is focused on finding individuals that want to make a difference but maybe don't know how, don't really understand the resources, and then providing them with resources. The way we do that is through, I think, the sort of the most fun events we host, or a lot of it's event driven, obviously it gets people energized if you can get them all in a room, are panel discussions where we get a mix of people. We'll get some straight allies in positions of leadership saying, we want to help, we just don't know how, we need people to tell us. We get people at every level that have been through the process saying, it's easy, it's, you know, it's progressive, you can make changes in your employment, and really discussing the positive impact it has on the workplace. And actually, we've got an event, and I think it's sort of fortuitous timing. We've got an event coming up now called The Allies at Work, and this is really focused on getting engagement from the 90%, 85%, I mean, pick your statistic, but the acknowledged overwhelming majority of our coworkers who are not members of the GLBT community, getting them to buy in and getting them to really take ownership of saying, you know, it's not Timmy's issue, or it's not Susie's issue, or it's not, you know, the person prancing down the hall's issue. This is my issue. It matters to me to have a workplace where everyone can come in. And then again, once that person makes that step, then giving them a toolkit. How do I go about doing that?
You know, it's not too long ago that none of these corporations even entered in the Pride Parade. And we've seen that. We've seen Chase, and we've seen some of the oil companies be part of it, whether officially sanctioned or whether some of the groups itself. But they've had some official sanction to be able to do that. And now that's only sort of a, you know, public face of this. It doesn't really tell you. As you go and work on this, is there also somewhat of a glass ceiling in some companies that, yeah, okay, maybe you could be this in a certain area of the company, maybe the creative department, because that's where we're supposed to be. But what about some of the higher level things, HR, corporate lawyers? I mean, you're working towards all aspects of this, right?
Absolutely. And I think the biggest fight we have now is twofold, and in on the first half, it's the perception that whether or not the glass ceiling actually exists from the perspective of all of the non-members of the community that we work with, whether or not they see the glass ceiling, as long as we see it, we're just as stuck. We're not going to advance beyond what we think we can get, regardless of whether they'd be willing to advance us. So it's about, first off, it's about changing the perception of the members of the community to say, no, I can be out at work. I can be who I want to be and not suffer the glass ceiling. And then, of course, there are truly some organizations that do have a glass ceiling. And then there, it's about bringing these resources. And it usually does start with the human resources group simply because they know everybody. They touch everybody in an organization from the top down. Proving to them the value, and I do mean value quite literally, the dollars that are either brought in the door or kept in the door by not discriminating against people because of their sexual orientation. And that is simply a matter of getting the toolkits, getting the resources out, educating the human resources professionals so that they can go to their leadership and say, tolerance in the workplace is more than a philosophical ideal. It is a bottom line profit driver.
Well, that's really interesting because I remember hearing a story on NPR about cities in general. Those cities that have a perception of not being open, and I think one of the city examples was Jacksonville, mm-hmm. that they really have this as compared to an Austin or San Francisco, where a lot of the companies, especially in San Francisco or New York, where these companies really have a much open thing that it not only helps the company, it just gives a better outlook to the city.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is that legally we have no protection in Texas, Harris County, or the city of Houston. So companies don't have to do this if they don't want to.
That is true. Companies are under no legal obligation. But again, and this is the message we keep trying to get out there, and I think when you interact with the people that participate with us, you'll see that the message is getting out there. This is a profit driver. I mean, at the end of the day, business people always respond to numbers. And if, as is the case, members of our community are among the most dedicated, among the most driven, among the most creative. I mean, some stereotypes have a basis in fact. Mm-hmm. And when you can tell somebody, we want you to bring your whole person to work, you set that free.
Right, right. We're talking to Matthew Sontag, who is, are you chapter president? What is your title?
Chief of Social Networking, I want to say.
Okay.
The talking face, if you will.
Okay. And how big is the organization here in Out and Equal we're talking about in Houston?
It's sort of hard to judge that. If you judge by people that are on the mailing list, it's a couple hundred people. If you judge by the number of companies whose representatives and even high-level representatives are on the mailing list, it's 50 to 75 of the major employers in the area. Judging by attendance at the various events, 100, 150 really active participants. But I think that really doesn't tell the full story. And again, it's because each one of these people is sort of the tip of an iceberg of support at their respective companies. They're taking the information they gather from participation with the Out and Equal Houston chapter. They're taking the content. They're taking the messaging. They're taking everything they learn and then pushing it out through their employee resource group, through their network of individuals within their firms. So in a sense, the organization is more about helping people help themselves internally than it is about driving raw numbers. And so I think in a lot of ways, the raw number doesn't tell the full story.
And as I'm going to expand on that story about Jacksonville, I mean, the high-tech industry used to be very, very sort of closeted. And then there was an organization that formed maybe 10, 15 years ago called Digital Queers that really tried to start changing that. That has really changed a lot with, GLBT people being part of that. Mm-hmm. And how do you look at the oil industry or the energy industry, do you see that changing? Is it a slow change? Is it, we do have major corporations that have non-discrimination, but yet again, ExxonMobil does not, correct?
That is true. And it's interesting. I actually know several individuals in the oil and gas industry, and it's not restricted to ExxonMobil, because again, even the most progressive corporate culture doesn't always extend down to the refinery level, the workman's level. I mean, if you're working with a group of individuals who, really have it kind of tough and don't necessarily have never interacted with an open homosexual, and to the extent they have, it's been in a context where that person may not have been giving the most flattering impression of our community. I mean, they've only interacted with stereotypes. And so there is a problem of getting the equality, the acceptance out down to that granular level. And again, that's sort of reflected in our push as we steadily push more and more towards allies, straight allies. The reality is at any given workplace, there may not be an open homosexual. There may, I mean, clearly more than 10 people, you got a pretty good chance of having at least one member of the LGBT community there. They may not be ready to come out. They may not be ready to address it. They just may not be in that place. But everywhere has either got an LGBT individual or somebody who would be willing to be a straight ally. And at the end of the day, having that person come out either as a member of the community or as a supporter of the community, though not themselves gay, that gets the message down to that level. And so the more we can push our straight coworkers to identify as straight allies, the better off we are. The other, and again, totally sort of tangential side effect is, the more we can get people who are actually straight supporters to come out of the closet as straight supporters, the less of a, oh, well, he must be gay stigma, or she must be a lesbian stigma that would attach to coming out of the closet as a supporter of the GLBT community. Right now, if, you know, a man or a woman in the workplace says, I believe in gay rights, the instantaneous reaction is, gee, wonder why. If we can get everyone to come out and say, no, you know, we really do believe in this. And it's not just we believe it in our hearts, but actually say it out loud in the workplace, put a sticker on your cube, whatever it is, symbolize that you are open about the fact that you support equality. You know, the more we can do that, the less stigma will be attached to it. And then people will finally realize, hey, they're okay.
Well, and you come from a younger generation.
Oh, yes.
And there is definitely a lot more acceptance in the younger generation. Certainly, I know I was walking through the festival this year, and I saw an awful lot of perceived straight people there, which is great. I mean, it's great that they're doing, you know, the fact that a lot of the gay bars are having trouble because gay people feel much more comfortable going to other bars, mm-hmm. and that's great. But at the same time, the older generation has been in, either has been, built that closet up over the years. It's hard for that to open up.
Indeed, and I think perhaps that's the key point is what we're going through right now is a transition in the workplace. 50 years from now, I think there's a pretty good bet we'll all look back and just sort of scratch our heads and like, well, that was weird. Why did we care? But right now, it's a matter of getting from here to there, getting from the current generation who, as it, you know, as the older generation grows, unfortunately, they grow into steadily more and more powerful leadership roles. So the people setting the policies at the local office-wide level are more likely to be from the older generation. The problem will age out. But again, also, it's just that progress isn't fast enough. And I think there are a lot of supporters in that community that just simply have not taken the time to step out and say, I am actually a supporter of the community. And again, it's about giving them the tools to do that.
Have you had any personal experience in dealing with this?
Absolutely. I actually started my career at a small land company where I was extremely closeted. I mean, I'm not exactly a stealth individual, so I think they probably all knew, but it was just something that was never talked about. Very uncomfortable environment. I wish I could say I'd done anything successfully to change that. The reality is the management there, at least the way I perceived it at the time, wasn't going to listen. From what I've learned now, maybe I was wrong. They would have been completely accepting. I didn't give them the chance. Moved to one of the companies, KPMG, that is actually a sponsor of Out and Equal and really believes in this. It comes from an industry that historically has not been the most accepting, the accounting, financial services. Again, a very non-diverse community. I mean, even despite our best efforts, if you look statistically, it's pretty much a white males club and at the upper levels. And believe me when I say they are doing everything humanly possible to change that. Part of it is simply the perception. Gay people tend not to go into that industry because there's a perception they won't be accepted. But, you know, with our employer, I will say that the willingness and the desire to have an accepting, inclusive environment was there from the beginning, from the first day I worked there. It really, truly was a group of incredibly supportive, predominantly straight individuals saying, we would love to have an open and accepting workplace. We don't know how. You know, we just literally, how do you make a homosexual feel comfortable in this environment. We just don't. I mean, what are we doing? And it's as simple as, well, when you ask a male coworker, "Would you have a wife?" You probably just made them feel uncomfortable. If they do, in fact, have a significant other that just doesn't happen to have the gender you assumed. And a lot of times, the people that we talk to just don't understand that it's as simple as that. They've never thought about it. And getting out there and saying to them, this is what you need to think about, makes all the difference in the world.
Great. So how do you organize? How could people get involved?
Well, we've got a mailing list, which keeps you very well up to date on everything, and it's not something that spams. I'm the one that sends them out, and it's a once a month newsletter with an occasional additional announcement. There's a couple of ways to find it. We do have a website. It's outandequal.org /Houston, or you can just search for Out and Equal Houston on Google. It'll totally come up. We're also on Facebook. OE Houston, facebook.com/OE Houston. But pretty much the easiest way, and it's sort of universal, is Google us. Once you're on the mailing list, like I said, once a month, you get all of the announcements of the events we're hosting. The mailing list is probably the best way to keep informed. But the other thing is, again, because we are sort of a volunteer-driven organization, as are most, but especially for our mission, it's about getting people to take ownership of change in their own workplace. Anybody that wants to do that, reach out to us more than just the mailing list. Email us at houston@outandequal.org, or go through Facebook and send one of us a message, and we will be happy to assist you as far as you can take it in your organization. The other thing is that a lot of people don't realize that their employer probably already has somebody that's involved, that just it hasn't percolated through the water cooler or the mailing list in their employer. But we can make those connections. And if one person's good, three people's a lot better, and sort of push things forward that way.
Great. Matthew Sontag is with Out and Equal here at the Houston chapter, and it's an organization about making it better for people in the corporate world to be out. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Happiness, it hits her like a train on a track. Coming taunt her, stuck, still no turning back. She hid around a corner, then she hid under beds. She killed it with kisses, in front of it she fled. With every bubble she sank with her drink, and she washed it away down the kitchen sink. The dark days are over her, the dark days are done. The horses are coming, carry it with you if you want to survive.
That was Gregory Douglas from a single released this year. The title of the track, Dog Days Are Over.
Don't think you can make a difference? Be part of a movement that can revolutionize the radio station you know and love. By joining KPFT's Sustainer program, you can support your station and help KPFT reduce its pledge drives. What's a Sustainer? Rather than giving a yearly gift, Sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving $20, $100, or $500 monthly helps change the way KPFT operates. From having to meet our operating expenses through days and days of on-air fundraising, to friends of the station boosting it off-air throughout the fiscal year. Contact our development director at 713-526-4000 to inquire about our Sustainer program. Did you know Sustainers can ultimately give a gift that is substantially larger than annual givers? That means less pledge drive, more efficiency, and greater stability for KPFT, regardless of the time of year. Again, just call our development director at 713-526-4000 to inquire about our Sustainer program. Make a difference today. This is KPFT Houston.
Hi, I'm Sam Gonzalez from the Sharptown High School Broadcasting Program. KPFT has just launched a new paperless system at kpft.org. Now, you can submit public service announcements, open journal proposals, and more through the station website, kpft.org. Going paperless is better for the environment and means your submissions arrive faster to KPFT offices. Do you have a nonprofit community event to promote? Do you have an idea for a program or want to host an open journal? Then visit kpft.org now to submit your application. While there, you can make a pledge online and support the great programming you love. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston. Love KPFT and its programming. Pledge drives, not so much. So this summer, KPFT invites you to participate in a bold experiment and join the 10% of KPFT listeners who donate monthly to KPFT.
Visit kpft.org today, click the Every Member Sustainer button, and do your part to increase that 10% of listeners sustaining to 100%.
With greater Sustainer support, KPFT can give you more of the great programming you love. Sustaining members make KPFT's future income predictable and steady, providing the fiscal stability KPFT needs to have fewer pledge drive days.
$5, $10, $15, or $20 a month from you makes all the difference. So visit kpft.org, click the Every Member Sustainer button, and become a sustainer of KPFT quickly and securely online.
You'll also be able to make sure your online donation goes to the credit of your favorite show, and you can pick out a thank you gift too.
Every Member Sustainer, join the club now at kpft.org. I'm Gloria Johnson.
And I'm Sam Gonzalez from the Sharptown High School Broadcasting Program.
This is KPFT Houston.
When you tune into KPFT, you notice something right away. No ads. KPFT is a non-commercial radio station. We don't accept advertising or underwriting from businesses, nor does KPFT receive payment for any program we air. KPFT further disallows product plugging or endorsements. We do this because you, the listener, deserve access to the radio you love.
Without all the commercials, taglines, and cross-promotion that corporate radio subjects you to.
If you ever hear something on KPFT that you have concerns about, please contact our program director at 713-526-4000 during regular business hours. If you enjoy this kind of option on Houston's airwaves, become a member. KPFT is able to stay commercial free because listeners like you make a pledge of support to keep us on the air. Your pledge is important. Call our membership department at 713-526-4000 or visit kpft.org to support KPFT with a pledge. Jason, can you give us that number again?
713-526-4000 or kpft.org to become a member.
KPFT, Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Just sing if you're happy. This way.
This is Brian Levinka.
Did you forget who you were there for a second?
I had a little black ale.
Yes, I'm Jennifer Renee, and we have two wonderful guests here in the studio with us.
And it's kind of a solemn occasion that we have these guests in the studio with us. And let's introduce our guests, Douglas Anderson and Alan Everett of the Aaron Sherhorn Foundation for Change. And if you're not aware of Aaron Sheerhorn, I guess maybe Douglas, can you tell us who he was and what happened in the community recently?
Yeah, thank you, Brian. On December the 10th, 2010, my dear friend Aaron was brutally stabbed to death at the corner of Pacific Street in Crocker, in front of Blur Bar, in front of numerous onlookers, and was actually turned away by the doorman, told to go somewhere else. And in that parking lot, his killer caught up to him and murdered him, got up, calmly walked away, and threw his knife to the ground. As you can imagine, I was really saddened and extremely angered about that. I was angry at his killer, the doorman, and the crowd that stood around and watched. And a few weeks later, the news broke about the politician in Arizona. And yes, I was even more angered because there was a group of people that tackled that guy, including, I believe, a 60-some-odd-year-old grandmother. So I had to do something, and so I got together with some friends that I met of his on Facebook, and we've been able to turn that anger into something positive.
Forming a foundation,
Yes, we did, the Aaron Sheerhorn Foundation for Change. This foundation is based upon making some positive changes in our neighborhood. Shortly after Aaron's passing, Jack had me on this program with a couple other members of the foundation. And it described in length his passing, his death, and basically put some ideals on the table about what this foundation would do. And in this brief four short months, we've been able to accomplish three of these things.
And what are they?
Well, first off, we thought about some way of honoring Aaron, and we had thought about a balloon release, a couple other things, and we decided to honor him in a more permanent way, and that would be to plant a tree.
Okay.
You know, we want to honor our friend by giving some gifts to our community, little projects. And we thought, what better way than to plant a tree? This tree is a vitex. Its bloom color is Montrose purple, which I thought was really appropriate. It's actually named after a little town in Montrose, England.
Oh, my God. That's
isn't that
wonderful
great?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah. It's a beautiful color, purple. So anyway, we were looking for a place to plant this tree. And through a dear friend, Ray Hill, we got communications with Charles Armstrong of Charles Armstrong Investments.
Right.
And he offered a great little corner. It's at the 1000 block of Grant, at the intersection of Grant and California, about one block north of Westheimer, right behind the Felix restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And it's actually
near Baba Yaga's, right?
Yes, okay. Correct, yeah. And it's taken on a life itself. Initially, it was a little humble beginning of just honoring Aaron, and through the gracious donation of Charles and the Glenwood Weber Landscape Architect Company, it's become a really magnificent little corner dedicated to the memory of all GLBT victims of hate crimes, violent crimes, and bullying.
Now, what's the number of that? Because you were talking before we went on the air that you have a list of a lot of those people.
I think
how many are there?
Alan has a list.
Alan,
list
how many was on this list?
Well, this is just people that we've
He's showing me a piece of paper that's full of names.
It's got 35 names of them, names of people who've been victims of violence going back as far as 1979.
Right.
I'm sure there have been a lot more
here
than
in the
that,
community.
But
right.
These are people in the community, GLBT people. Some of them are victims of bullying. Some of them victims of hate crime. Some of them just victims of just random violence. But anyway, these are just names that we've been made aware of. And the interesting thing about it, and the really sad thing about it, is that almost half of them are TG people.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
So, you know, this has a special significance to the TG community.
Well, the transgender community has always been placed in an awkward position. It seems to be the almost three times as more likely to be a victim of hate crimes, and the crimes themselves are much more violent. yes. than other some other yes. hate
we've,
crimes.
We've listed here what the how people have been murdered, and it's really brutal and shocking to read that. It's devastating.
It's great that this is done, and thanks to Charles Armstrong for stepping up in the landscape company. That's
now,
great.
We're leading up to, there's a dedication coming up and of the memorial itself.
That's correct, on July 28th, which is a Thursday night at 8 o'clock.
So not this Thursday, but a week from this Thursday.
That's correct. There will be a dedication ceremony. We've invited a lot of people. We're not sure who's exactly is coming yet.
But we want as many people as possible.
We want as many people there as possible, and it's.
Is there enough room for everybody?
Well, there's a interesting enough. Behind this little garden, and I'm showing you a picture of it.
For those of you out there, I'm being shown a picture.
Yeah. There is a huge parking lot behind the garden, separated by a fence.
Oh, okay.
And if we can have a pride parade of 100,000 people, we can fit, you know, hundreds of people.
That is a large parking lot, and Charles is going to erect a stage back there and have lights, cameras, action, and there's going to be speeches and. It's also going to be a solemn ceremony. It will be a very moving and touching ceremony.
This was your friend.
Yes.
And, I mean, what was that impact, that moment that somebody said? And you talked about the anger, about, you know, people standing around watching and no one taking action and the doorman turning him away from safety. How did you feel? How did it impact your life?
How did it impact my life? That's a good question. Again, I was overwhelmed with anger. You know, not only at his killer, Lydell Grant, whose case I've followed. Members of the foundation and myself have been in the courtroom every time he's appeared. But I was also really angry at the doorman and at the apathy that prevailed that night, the indifference. I mean, there was a crowd of people waiting to get into that Blur nightclub, and they just stood there. And how did I deal with it?
Well, they have to live with their inaction, too.
That's true. What I've been able to do through a lot of prayer and a lot of help from my friends and an unbelievable amount of support from the terrific people that I've met in the past few months is to change that anger into action. I decided that I'm going to do what little part I can, and through the help of my dear friends that I've met, make some changes in this community. You know, when I was on the radio the first time, Jack, I think, said it most eloquently in describing life in Montrose, was it's like living in a small town in the middle of a big city.
Mm-hmm. Oh, true.
And that's how I felt when I first moved here in 1982. And I have a personal belief that as a citizen of this community, myself and others have a responsibility for our community. And I have discovered that the city of Houston, our police force, is stretched to their limits. You know, one of our projects is a Citizens on Patrol group, the Aaron's Angels. And I initially thought when we were to approach HPD that we would be told to go back inside and leave the crime fighting to us. But that wasn't so.
Oh, no. We cleaned up during the 80s with Q Patrol.
I was going to ask, is this similar to Q Patrol or resurrection of that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very similar. Well, Citizens on Patrol is an... an initiative by the police department around the city. It is something that's been an ongoing group of citizens in various communities and neighborhoods that are put together, trained by the police mm-hmm. to report crime and not to intercede and act as police officers, but be the eyes and ears necessary yeah. to get the police to yeah. react properly.
Yes, that's correct. One of the things that's become very clear to me is that people want to help and they want to make change and they want to participate in their community, but they don't know how. And so that's one of the things that I hope the Aaron Sherhorn Foundation can, one of its roles in the community will be a way that people can learn how they can contribute and to better their community. One of the other programs that we have, and I'm really proud of, is our Safe Shelter program. You know, Aaron, I'm not going to blame his death on the Blur Bar doorman, but the one simple act of kindness to have let Aaron into the nightclub, I wouldn't be sitting here tonight.
No one would be talking about it.
We would not be talking about this. He approached that doorman. He showed the doorman the wound that he had on his chest, the initial stab wound, asked for his help, and the doorman told him to go away. Aaron did exactly what any of us would do in that situation.
What was that doorman's name?
I don't know. He did exactly what any of us would have done, and that was run towards lights and people.
Right.
And our community as a whole failed him that night. So one of our programs is the Safe Shelter program. We've had a local GLBT attorney, John Neacham, draw up a contract, which is a simple statement that the business or club owner will see to it that if someone comes to them in need of help, that they will educate their staff on how to help this person, bring them in, give them asylum, and call the proper authorities. And it also includes a little sticker to go on their front door window so that people can identify it as a safe shelter business.
That's terrific.
That's a huge
That's
change.
Huge.
Change our community.
I mean, there was an unwritten code by a number of bar owners that that was the case. But it's a shame that he was tried to get into another place.
Right, and in this case, it was he was told to take his business outside, take the trouble outside, not bring it into the club.
I found out during our patrol training with HPD that every time a club has HPD come there for any incident, they're red flagged. They're flagged. And upon the renewal of their TABC liquor license, all that's brought to light, and the renewal of their license can hinge upon how many times HPD was called out there. And to me, a human life is not worth a liquor license.
Oh my God, no.
It's just unacceptable.
Unacceptable.
Well, it needs to be a provision or a caveat that's sent along with that application saying that this was a, you know, why the police had were coming out. A letter from the police stating the why.
Yeah.
You know, to protect an individual. Mm-hmm. What else is on store for the event? I'd like to know a little more about the event.
As Alan said, it's going to be a rather solemn event. We're here to dedicate and to remember this. We're here to dedicate this little garden, and it's to honor and remember these victims of violent crime, bullying, and hate crimes. You know, it's appalling that someone is murdered just because of who they are. You know, I just find that unfathomable.
I'm quite sensitive to that.
Yes. And, you know, as we were talking earlier, the description of these murders is just, it's heartbreaking. They're vicious. Absolutely vicious. So we plan on, well, Alan, do you want to discuss the program?
Yeah, Alan, tell us more about it.
Well, like I said before, there are going, you know, we've invited some community leaders, elected officials, and then there will be some people who have lost family members or lost loved ones due to violence. We've invited Nancy Rodriguez, who is the mother of Paul Broussard, who was
so
we're murdered 20 years ago.
20-year anniversary, so that's kind of a very
And that's what prompted Q Patrol.
Yes. Exactly, and that's
going to be
one of
powerful.
The things that Charles Armstrong was real interested in, was getting Nancy here to help us dedicate this garden. I'm not sure if she's going to be here. She's from out of state. But another person we've invited is David, and I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name, Truong, who is the father of Asher Brown.
Asher Brown, right.
And we've also invited Lou Weaver, who is a leader in the TG community.
Yes.
And these people, we wanted them to, you know, say a few words about, you know, losing someone to violence, or whether it's hate crimes or bullying or just, you know, random violence. Yeah. Another really important person that we've really grown to love and know is Freddie Jensen. And I'd like you to talk about her.
Well, Freddie Jensen, she has a remarkable story. Her son, Noel Davis, was brutally murdered about 2 years ago in 2008. And we are going to see if we can have her speak at the end for some healing remarks. I've come to believe that we're probably going to be opening a lot of old wounds, and there's going to be a lot of emotions. And Freddie Jensen has this wonderful website called Healing Out Loud. And she is such a remarkable person. Due to her religious beliefs, when she discovered her son Noel was gay, she pretty much detached from him. And then after his horrible murder, she realized that that was such just wasted time, you know, that she has discovered that she needs to focus on the important things of life. And so she believes, and I do so, that her son Noel is guiding her today. She comes along and gives these tremendous speeches on being the change that you want to see in the world.
Got that.
Change that you want to see in the world.
Well, this is marvelous that you're putting on. I was gonna say that, you know, the transgender community has the Day of Remembrance in late November, which very much so, like on this sheet of paper you can't see, that says gives them person's name, a transgender identified individual who has been murdered. And then describes how that occurred. And so I'm, you know, for me on a personal basis, this is just, you know, very inspiring to me that you're doing it and you're taking everyone in there, not just the transgender community like we do in November, but everyone that's been victim of violence in our community, due to hate.
And, we're calling this the Montrose Remembrance Garden. And if people want to find out more about it, they can go to Facebook. We have a Facebook page, and the name of it is Montrose Remembrance Garden.
Okay.
And an interesting thing is that people will be able to use this garden for, you know, if they have a special occasion or something. Charles has, you know, told us that he wants people to use this garden to have little, you know, if you have a ceremony, when you have your transgender Day of Remembrance, then that would be a nice place, you know, if you choose, that you can, you know, go there and maybe have a little candlelight vigil or something. And anyway, it's the purpose of this small garden is for people to use it and not for it to just sit there. But we're talking about putting pavers there with people's names on them.
Excellent idea.
I mean, it's kind of the epicenter of where some of the violence has happened.
Yes, it's right in the heart of Montrose. It's right halfway between Felix Restaurant and Baba Yaga's.
It's
and
the perfect place
for everyone that knows Montrose should know exactly where that is.
Yes. I just hope that, and I just really do hope and pray that this little spot, as time goes on, that it can be a place of healing for people, you know. I do realize that it's also going to represent some tragic memories, but I do think that it can also be a place of healing.
Absolutely. But it's a response to the violence and what we did after that and how we came together.
Yes.
So the event is week from Thursday.
Now, that's what date is that?
July 28th.
And what time is it?
8 o'clock.
8 p.m.
And it's the
1,000 block of California. It's at the corner of Grant and California Street. That's one block north of Westheimer and one block east of Montrose.
And if you have to, you can easily go to Facebook and look for
the Montrose Remembrance Garden.
Or the Aaron Sherhorn Foundation for Change. Two different sites.
Either way, they can get the information.
That's right.
I want to thank you very much for coming on tonight.
Thank you so much, Jennifer, Renee, and Brian.
Thank you. And this is Queer Voices. Just believe.
Trust in this world, still people are dying.
Was David Dubb, and the name of the song Believe from the album of the same name. And actually, our thanks to J.D. Doyle for providing all of the music that you hear on the show here. There's more David Dubb that you can hear on J.D.'s website. It's actually part of J.D.'s Out Radio program for June. So if you go to J.D.'s website, Queer Music Heritage, you can just Google that. It's all one word, and you'll find more of David Dubb there. This is Queer Voices.
And this is Brian Levinka.
And Jennifer Renee.
And if you're a listener of Queer Voices, you know that we sometimes have gay theatrical companies and productions.
Love the theater.
Yes, and we especially...
The musicals. It's in our blood, you know that?
It's totally
in our genes.
I have my pink blood is very theatrical and Broadway. But we loved Unhinged Productions, and they have come up with something new and gay and fabulous, which I was very excited to see last Friday. So in the studio, we have Chris Rivera.
Hello.
Hello. Josiah Franklin.
Hello.
And Courtney LaMelo.
Hey there.
Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, you did.
So we have the two leads of the production of A Midsummer Night's Dream by Unhinged Productions.
Now, there's something different about that, isn't there, Brian?
There is. And Chris is the director.
Yes.
So tell us, what is different about this production?
A lot is different about this production. And some of it we have to keep a secret until you see the show. But... For Unhinged, because it's a GLBT theater, Joe Angel Babb, the artistic director, brought it to me with the idea of Lysandra and Hermia, normally Lysander and Hermia being a lesbian couple,
and Demetrius and Helenus, normally Demetrius and Helena, being a gay couple. And it really transformed the show into something different for the characters, and the setting for the show is, I feel, something that's going to resonate with modern audience very well.
It's very timely, I think, in terms of kind of the community struggle and kind of where we are, and I kind of felt like a resonance with that.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many topics where, I say in the program, a gay marriage is being voted on, and other people are making that choice, but straight people aren't being in a position where anyone can tell them who they can marry in America.
Yeah, we don't get to vote on theirs.
Exactly. And this play takes place in a very modern world, and where we would escape to when we live in the suburbs in a strict world.
Right. Now, Josiah, you play a dual role, I understand. Well, I saw.
Yes, Theseus and Oberon.
Okay, so tell us about your role.
Well, Theseus is the Duke of Athens, so he pretty much has to carry out the law. And so the law pretty much is you either obey your parents or you die. Mm-hmm. Or you can live the life of a nun.
Right. So die, yeah.
If you call it life.
Okay.
Some of us here die.
Which in a sense you die, but kind of in another way.
On the inside.
Yes.
And then the Oberon.
And then Oberon. Oberon is a fun character to play. He's the king of the fairies. And so when we start the play, Oberon and Titania have been fighting. Hmm. And so there's a disturbance in the universe.
Yes.
And Courtney, yes. What's your role?
I play Hippolyta and Titania. Hippolyta is the Amazon queen, and she has been basically captured or wooed in battle by Theseus.
And my sword.
And his sword, yes. And she comes into a very strict world of Athens that she doesn't understand the rules. And she's appalled by the strictness, and I think the fact that these lovers are what's the word I'm looking for?
Being controlled.
They're not being controlled, definitely. That they're being controlled. Because I think in you know, the Amazon world, that's very acceptable. And then, like Josiah said, Titania and Oberon are fighting, and she wants things to be right. So even though she's very angry with him, she's trying to make things right in this very magical world, and she's got these wonderful fairies. The fairies are amazing. Mm. And so she's trying to make things right with him.
Now, one thing that I noticed, and I know that there was an effort to do, is to make this an unhatched production, to get the teen actors and kind of incorporate them. And you had a huge cast, what, like?
It's a cast of 19.
19.
And a lot of the people are in double roles.
Yes.
But yes, there's a lot of young people in the show. A lot of people who are doing their first show right out of high school, but they rose to the challenge.
They're very talented.
Yeah, I think part of the reason that Joe Angel had me direct is because I'm taught at the Alley since 2004, mm-hmm. and I teach for Lone Star Actors Studio. And I think they really brought a lot to the table. I think they're absolutely fantastic.
I mean, having the teenage, you know, perspective in those roles, I mean, it was, you kind of experienced the kind of that role in that time in your life.
Yeah, I think so many times, like, you see Romeo and Juliet or you see this show and the actors are in their late 20s, and there's a magic that of being that young and in love that we don't understand anymore.
Yeah, it's refreshing. It really is.
It's so beautiful to see how they are in love.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to talk about the costumes and the set and just, you know, the lights and just how you transformed it into the fairy kingdom, I guess.
Well, I guess I'll spill a little bit about what the woods are.
Am I spilling the beans?
No, I'll spill what the woods are. I don't want to spill certain things about a certain actor, character that transforms. But the woods, in Shakespeare's time, in a lot of Shakespeare's play, the characters run into this green area, the Forest of Arden, the woods.
Right.
And that's where people were free. And in London, in his time, that's where people went to go crazy. In our time, that's not exactly where we go to go crazy. No. We go to the club, we go to the middle of the city, we go to have a wild time, and that's where these characters run away to, this urban, beautiful, magical, fairy circuit party.
Yes, the lights and, you know, the wings and everything. Mm-hmm. It's just fantastic.
Thank you. I did the costumes too, and I'm very proud of the final
look. I knew there was a gay man behind me.
When it's got lots of color, it always is.
It has lots of color. So besides changing, I guess, pronouns from the original play, what other changes did you make?
We made some cuts. I mean, it's a bit long, and there's some jokes that don't hit the same way they used to. Very, very minimal changes besides pronouns. Because of the gender role, there's a line that for Beats in Shakespeare, you have to, it's daughter, and I made it young son, because you need two syllables. Besides that, it's just cuts. I'm a contaminant. But besides that, it's just a few cuts of things that didn't work.
I also think a lot of it was played more toward the literal language. Mm-hmm. So it's very, if somebody doesn't like Shakespeare, God forbid, or you know, has a hard time understanding, this show, I mean, you can really understand.
There's a lot of physical.
Exactly.
You can pick it up.
Exactly.
Yes. So, I know that you're supposed to be asking us questions, but what did you think of the show as a viewer? Because we're biased. We can say it's great all day.
You stole my thunder. I was going to start interviewing him now, but that's okay.
Oh, you do it. Sorry, you do it.
No. Well, Brian, what did you think about the show now?
I have to admit, I'm a lover of theater. Shakespeare, not so much. I mean, I like more of the kind of Broadway and more of the traditional plays. But like you said, with this play, you get into the Shakespeare and you get into the physical and you kind of become part of this world. And, you know, the story is very relevant. And to see the young actors and to see them in costume and enjoying themselves and just nailing the lines, which I know is pretty, it has to be tough. But, I mean, there was a wide range of performances. And, I mean, it was magical. You know, one thing you need to discuss is the new space.
Yes.
That was a new, I like the new space, too.
Yeah, it's in the Heights. It's Obsidian Arts space. Mm-hmm. It's right off White Oak near Onion Creek, if you're familiar. Probably this is a good time for me to drop, you know, website and phone number, too.
Why don't you
slide
do that?
It in there. But if you're interested in the show, it's comeunhinged.com or call 832-250-7786.
And that's COME.
COME. It is COME.
Oh, Josiah.
For a gay show, you have to.
You should make it up. It's true.
So, opening night was last Friday.
Mm-hmm.
How many more weeks do we have?
Two more. This next weekend and the week after.
Okay, so you have to go and see it.
Yeah, you have to
go. If you're listening to us now, go. I mean, you live in Houston. Absorb the culture and go out into a theater and play and enjoy what we have to offer.
And Unhinged productions are always fun. You know, if you're accustomed to going to the theater and to especially named shows, and you expect something that you've seen before, you never see it that way at an Unhinged. It is always a treat.
There's a twist.
This is definitely a show that's fun. This is not your mama's Shakespeare, is what trying to say. This is definitely.
It's not Shakespeare. Shakespeare
new.
Is what you're trying to say.
But I think Shakespeare would have written it like this.
I think so.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think he would have added Lady Gaga.
Probably so.
That's who Titania is, basically. No, but I really wanted to direct a show that people who've seen the show before can see it and find something new and magical in, and people who haven't seen the show before can feel totally in it, and it's accessible to them, and it still makes sense, and it's still a beautiful, entertaining night for them.
Because the basic story is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Most of the words, it's just that now the tone of things, the reason this parent doesn't want their child to marry this person is homophobia. The reason this person doesn't want to be with the person they've been in love with forever and suddenly is chasing someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Is because they don't want to be gay.
And how ironic that that's relevant today. I mean, that story transcends the time and comes relevant.
Yeah, it's still a story about young people who can't be with who they want to be.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the great... I think that minority of kids today, even though it's much, much better than it was a few decades ago, is still the most prosecuted as far as that.
Oh, absolutely.
Much more so than even... couples of two different races are nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you talk about Unhinged Productions and maybe where it came from, the history, what they do normally throughout the year? Is that
I can a little bit because I'm a board member. I used to be a board member. Unhinged is about 10 years old.
10 years old.
Over. Mm-hmm. It's been committed to doing GLBT theater. And it has done wonderful productions throughout the years. Different actors have won awards, local awards for parts in the show. And they've been a great place in the GLBT community and the theater community for art.
And what do you have coming up next after this? Do you have...
Next is An Unknown Season.
is that the name of it? Or is it, it is. Where
it
you're
is,
keeping
it is.
The secret?
No, it is. It's a secret, and that's the current name of it. But basically, Unhinged is reaching out to the local community of artists, seeing who wants to commit to being a part of something, and really basing the show off who in the community of artists. But both shows that are going to be done next year off the community of artists that want to be a part of Unhinged.
Do you need volunteers?
Absolutely. If you are a theater artist, you should absolutely look at Unhinged Productions, and especially GLBT theater artist who doesn't feel that maybe their voice is getting out there as much. Unhinged might be a wonderful place for you. We need designers, performers.
Okay, so
even writers.
Where can they get tickets? How many more performances are left?
Again, we have two more weekends. Friday and Saturday nights are at 8 o'clock. We've got Sunday matinees at 2:30. You can go to comeunhinged.com or call 832-250-7786. The theater's at 3522 Wide Oak Drive. It's Obsidian Art Space. Please come out and see us. It's wonderfully fabulous, magical. We can't wait to see you there.
It is a big fairy circuit party. It's fabulous.
I mean, it's a gale time. Is there anything else you want our listeners to let us know about Unhinged? Josiah, you're very quiet.
I'm typically very quiet when I'm not on the stage.
Well, just consider this a stage.
Well, a lot of our performers are not gay. That's probably what a lot of people do not know about Unhinged Productions.
I didn't know that.
So we have very gay-friendly performers. Mm-hmm. And maybe the majority are not gay that are in the production.
The beautiful thing about, I think, young people today and teens, we were talking about a bit of this outside, is how teens don't want to be labeled at this age nowadays. And they're free not to be. There are several teens in the show who don't identify as straight and don't identify as gay and just are, and they'll love whoever they want to. And I think that's beautiful. I think that's
crazy.
A great time in your life.
It's crazy young kids.
It's crazy young kids.
Straight actors.
I just love those kids.
It's wonderful that straight actors would really come on board to support gay issues.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the new world today, that mm-hmm. you have a lot of youth really supporting a lot of gay people. And I think that's why the tide is beginning to turn again.
Absolutely. And what's always talked about is we're one generation away.
Yeah. So do yourself a favor and go check out Unhinged Productions of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Comeunhinged.com. And thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And this is Queer Voices.
The stories of people who live at the intersection of immigration reform and marriage equality are coming up later in the program. But first, Republican presidential hopeful and U.S. Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota and her husband Marcus are very much into bondage and discipline, at least when it comes to lesbians and gay men.
If you're involved in the gay and lesbian lifestyle, it's bondage. It is personal bondage, personal despair, and personal enslavement. And that's why this is so dangerous. It's a very sad life. It's part of Satan, I think, to say that this is gay. It's anything but gay.
What do you say when your teenager says she's gay?
There's that curiosity. But again, it is as if we have to understand barbarians need to be educated. They need to be disciplined.
According to recent polls, Mrs. Bachmann has a strong lead over fellow GOP presidential candidates in Iowa, the first state to officially tally presidential preferences leading up to the November 2012 election. But a gay activist has exposed a counseling center owned by the couple and operated by Mr. Bachmann as a promoter of so-called reparative therapy, a debunked practice that promises gays and lesbians that they can become heterosexual. Every major psychological and psychiatric organization has refuted the notion that sexual orientation can be changed. Critics say that encouraging lesbians and gay men to believe that they can change also reinforces internalized homophobia, fosters depression and suicidal thoughts, and does other real mental health damage. Bachmann and Associates has been collecting tens of thousands of dollars in annual Medicaid payments for the treatment of patients. It also received $24,000 in recent years under a state grant to train employees. The Bachmanns have refused to say whether or not any of those federal or state funds were used to support the clinic's discredited change therapies.
What is your opinion on reparative therapy, and is it something that is conducted at that center?
Well, I'm running for the presidency of the United States, and I'm here today to talk about job creation and also the fact that we do have a business that deals with job creation. We're very proud of the business that we've created.
John Becker, an activist with Truth Wins Out, an LGBT group dedicated to exposing ex-gay quacks, posted an undercover video report last week detailing his 8-day experience seeking reparative therapy at Bachman & Associates. It's been widely circulated on the net and was featured this week on at least 7 U.S. network and cable news programs. It includes a Bachman & Associates counselor telling Becker that God designed men to be attracted to women, and that with prayer and effort, he could eventually become heterosexual. Becker described his experiences during a conversation with Ed Schultz on MSNBC's The Ed Show.
John, good to have you with us tonight here on the program. What were you trying to accomplish on this mission? What did you want to do?
We wanted to see for ourselves whether or not the clinic that's owned by Marcus and Michelle Bachman engages in reparative therapy, which, as you pointed out, is a completely scientifically discredited practice that purports falsely to change people from gay to straight. We felt that these rumors had gone unconfirmed for long enough, and that the American people deserve to know whether or not the Bachmans were tied to something that extreme.
Had you ever done anything like this before?
Personally, no, I had not. This was my first experience.
Okay, so you go into this, eyes wide open. Was it hard to comprehend what he was saying and also capture everything he wanted to capture?
It was what I tried to do myself was to put myself back into the mental place that I was at when I was a teenager, because I struggled to come to terms with my own sexual orientation.
You provided NBC News with a good deal of this footage. Was it clear that this counselor, in your mind, was clearly using the technique of reparative therapy?
Absolutely, and that's why I asked him several times just to make sure that I understood what he was saying. You know, is it possible to be free of same-sex attraction? And that promise for, you know, the potential of change is a very key component to reparative therapy.
But was the counselor doing anything illegal, in your opinion?
I don't have any legal training, so I guess I leave that to sharper minds than myself to sort out. I was never given any kind of informed consent document to sign, you know, outlining the risks of reparative therapy, including elevated risk of depression and suicide and possible alternatives like gay affirmative therapy. So I don't know about legality of it, but certainly ethically it's very, very shaky ground.
And what do you think this clinic says about Congresswoman Michelle Bachman, who wants to be president of the United States?
I think it says that she holds a very, very dangerously archaic view of the LGBT population in the United States, and I think that that's very telling in terms of how the policy she would enact and the way she would deal with the LGBT community were she to become president.
John Becker of Truth Wins Out with Ed Schultz on MSNBC's The Ed Show. Marcus Bachman confirmed during an interview with the Minneapolis Star Tribune this week that his so-called Christian Counseling Center does use reparative therapy, but claimed that it's only when a client specifically requests it. Right-wing groups and media outlets also rushed to the Bachman's defense. Fox News called the undercover video a hit piece. The Christian Broadcasting Network insisted that sexual orientation can be changed. Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council called Bachman and Associates a ministry of hope offering a path to sexual healing. The American Family Association and the National Organization for Marriage also issued statements in support of the Bachmans and of change therapy. Michelle Bachman has become a favorite target of political pundits and comedians for mangling American history and the English language. And as Jon Stewart of Comedy Central's The Daily Show reported this week, she also had a lot of nerve mangling a common Yiddish word.
The president doesn't want to have to be confronted with priorities and spending because he has a lot of chutzpah.
You know, I got a feeling saying the word chutzpah is going to hurt more grandmothers than Obama cutting off their Social Security. I think both parties have already lost Florida. Chutzpah sounds like she's talking out of her tuchus.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights. An informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
This week, a U.S. immigration judge in San Francisco delayed the deportation of the Venezuelan half of a gay couple for 2 years. Alex Benchimol and his husband, Doug Gentry, hope that by that time, the fate of the Defense of Marriage Act will be settled. DOMA prevents federal recognition of same-gender partners, but its constitutionality has been under attack. The Obama Justice Department has stopped defending cases based on DOMA's one-man, one-woman definition of marriage. But the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency of the Department of Homeland Security has made no such commitment. Judge Marilyn Teeter told prosecutors this week to decide in 60 days whether or not to press the case against Benchimol and Gentry and schedule the hearing for September of 2013 if they do. Most binational love stories like this one have been far less hopeful. Judy Rickard and Karen Bogliolo know firsthand what it's like to be torn apart, united by love, divided by law. That's the title of Judy's new book about the perils faced by same-gender binational partners in the U.S. It all started with a harrowing experience they shared with This Way Out correspondent Linda Birch.
Hi, my name is Karen Bogliolo, and I am the European half of this relationship.
I'm Judy Rickard. I'm the American partner, and I'm Karen's wife. I wrote the book to educate people and to advocate for the changes that need to be made, and any money that is derived from the sale of the book goes to the three groups that are working on this issue. That would be Immigration Equality, Out for Immigration, and Love Exiles. And I do hope that we sell enough books to be able to generate some income for those worthy groups. The issue for us, you know, a lesbian binational couple, same thing with a gay male binational couple, is the fact that we have an immigration system that does not recognize us as spouses.
What that means for Judy and Karen and more than 36,000 same-sex binational couples is constant fear over arbitrary immigration rules, a fear that became a reality one day for them.
Well, Judy and I had been in Europe together, and on the way back, as usual, we have to go into two different lines. And for the first time, and this had never happened to me before, they kept me a long time, first of all, at the gate where you come in, and then they said, we need you to come with us. And so they took me to another place and put me in a cell-like room. And then three people came and interrogated me for nearly 3 hours. I had just come over on a 12-hour flight. I was exhausted. You know, I am 70 years old. I'm not 14. You know, I was very, very tired. I asked for a glass of water, and they say no. I said, can I make a phone call to tell my friends where I am? No. And I said, don't I have any power? Don't I even get to make one phone call? No, you don't. We have all the power, and we can send you straight back. And it was one of the most horrifying times of my life. And it wasn't so much that I was scared. It was like I was numb. I was completely, I couldn't understand why they would do that to me. You know, I who have never done anything illegal or wasn't even intending to ever, and that they wouldn't believe anything I said. And ever since then, you know, when I came out, they did eventually let me in. And I have had a series of panic attacks, and I've had to go and see my doctor. And ever since then, I've been taking pills to stop this panic attack thing that I've been getting. And I thought maybe I was over it. And then this year, when I came back, it happened all over again.
Did they ever explain why? What was it about you that drew them to you?
They said, you may overstay your visa. And I said, look at my record. Here's my passport. You have seen how many times I've been in the United States. And have I ever overstayed my visa? Well, no, but you might. It's soul-destroying when somebody has you cornered like that.
And telling that you might commit a crime.
Yes. Not that I had to be innocent. I had to prove myself innocent before I'd even done anything.
What did they tell you about her disappearing?
They didn't tell me anything. When I was standing there with the luggage, I kept looking back to see where Karen was. And she was standing there at the booth, and I looked back again, and she was gone. And so I was standing there with the luggage, and one of the guys came over from the airport security and said, "You have to move. You can't just stay here. You're loitering, and you can't loiter here." And I said, "Well, I'm with somebody, and she's disappeared. They've taken her somewhere." And he said, "Well, you have to go through the doors and go out to the lobby and wait." And at that point, I knew something had really, you know, happened that we hadn't planned on. And so my sister and her husband were picking us up. So I called them and said, "You're going to have to park the car, and we're going to have to wait for Karen. Something's happened. I don't know what it is." But and so we ended up sitting there for hours until Karen finally came out. And she was just shaken to the core, and we were all confused and upset. And Karen just wanted to get out of there as fast as she could, so we drove away. But, you know, this incident that happened in April of 2008 was really the beginning of the end for us in terms of how we were going to continue to live our lives, because they told Karen that day that she was going to have to leave the country for a long time. And so when I went back to work, I told my boss that I was going to have to take early retirement so that we could be together, because I can't keep leaving my job or leave my job for a long time and have it be there when I get back. So that's when things really changed for us.
So this is harming you economically.
Yeah, it really bothered us both emotionally, Karen physically, and it sent us down a path for reduced income for the rest of our lives.
Not one to give up without a fight, Judy went to work on a book detailing not just her story, but dozens of other couples and families, providing information about legislation that will help keep American families together.
If loving parents are separated by what I consider archaic immigration laws, the cost is just unimaginable to a child. And we know children that are now teenagers that are working to lobby for the laws so that they can keep their both their moms, their second mom, here. And they go up to Congress people and say, "What are you going to do to keep my mom in America? It's terrific." Well, the two bills that are of interest in terms of our immigration status would be the Uniting American Families Act and Reuniting Families Act. And Uniting American Families Act was reintroduced by Senator Leahy and Congressman Nadler. And these two gentlemen have been working on this for over a decade. I'm so proud of them for their work. And then the newer bill that came along in 2009 by Congressman Honda is Reuniting Families Act, which is his take on comprehensive immigration reform. Uniting American Families Act only talks about LGBT binational couples. Reuniting Families Act completely embeds Uniting American Families Act into a comprehensive immigration bill. So if Uniting American Families Act passes, that'll help people like me and Karen. If Reuniting Families Act passes, that'll help us plus other people facing other immigration challenges. So both of them are good solutions.
To learn more about Judy's book or same-sex immigration resources, go to tornapart.findhornpress.com, where Judy blogs about immigration issues and more. For This Way Out, I'm Linda Birch.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Jen Mahoney, Sarah Sweeney, and Linda Birch contributed program material. Thanks also to Steve Pride and Kate Clinton. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and the generosity of our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to learn how you fit in, listen to our podcasts, read this week's news wrap, subscribe to CDs of our programs, and link up with us on our blog and our Facebook fan page. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email TWORadio@AOL.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Welcome to our new listeners on WRFN Nashville, Tennessee, and WDRT for Oak Grove, Wisconsin. Thanks also for listening on 3PVR Mill Park, Victoria, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, Summer Iman, and Jack Valensky. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack@queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning, starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
I'm Joseph Mitchell from the Sharpstown High School Broadcaster Program. KPFT's own Pacifica Radio Archives is asking for KPFT listeners to help with an urgent preservation project. The archives are looking for copies of historical KPFT folio program guides.
The Fabulous Internet Archives have agreed to donate scanning and online access services to Pacifica, and now is our shot to save the KPFT history.
If you have folios, mail them here to the station. Drop them off or send them to the Pacifica Radio Archives in Los Angeles. Go to PacificaRadioArchives.org to get the address.
Soon, our history will be available for the world to access. I'm Sam Gonzalez from the Sharptown High School Broadcasting Program.
This is KPFT Houston.
KPFT is pleased to announce new programming. Now with an HD radio receiver, you can get KPFT's great music, news, and public affairs with a richer, crisper sound on HD1. On KPFT HD2, listen to Rice University Radio with the unique programming that made KTRU a gem on the dial. On KPFT HD3, you'll hear your favorites in new time slots, including Democracy Now!, Al Jazeera English, Uprising, Explorations, Alternative Radio, and more. HD Radio allows you to hear multiple programs through additional digital channels. The sound is crisper than FM, and your choices are expanded. Visit kpft.org to learn more about HD Radio broadcasting and program schedules. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1, and now alternative programming on HD2 and 3. KPFT, Houston.
I am the voice of Pacifica Radio.
Ana Sol Radio Pacifica al KPFT 90.1 FM for Houston.
Unasikiza 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Yawad hai Pacifica Radio KPFT 90.1 FM.
Oh hi Pacifica Toy Kissing.
Chaliye aaj hum sab milkar ke is dharti pe shanti ke liye.
Chúng tôi muốn nói lên sự thật cho giới lãnh đạo được biết. Chúng tôi là Pacifica Radio KPFT 90.1 FM.
一同向和平進發，我哋係侯斯頓嘅 Pacifica KPFT 90.1 FM 90.1.
Mimi ni Pacifica, uhuru wa mazungumzo kwa watu walio huru.
Hum taqat ke samne bhi sachai se bolte hain. Hum hain Pacifica Radio KPFT 90.1 FM.
Let's all get together and pray for the peace on